Whoa.
That is mind
Yeah,
blowing.
this. So you're saying that everyone, okay, not everyone, but a lot of the people who are listening to this podcast are probably related to Genghis Khan,
Yeah,
in a
it's true.
sense.
Yes, because if you can say that Genghis Khan has a descendant today, then he must be an ancestor to everybody today if he has passed the isogenetic point.
Hey there, welcome to Void Deck, a casual science podcast brought to you by Science Centre Singapore. We bring science out of the labs and put scientists in singlets. Each episode, we sit back with a local science changemaker and ask all the questions that you are too paisei to ask. I'm your host, Rishi, and today we're joined by my colleague, JC, a science educator at the centre.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, JC, and today's episode is on tracing Peranakan ancestry. You've probably seen those vibrant Peranakan shophouses in Joo Chiat, but how did this unique community come to be in Singapore? To discover more, we speak with Prof. Roger Fu, the first Zayed bin Sultan Al Nahyan Professor of Medicine at the National University of Singapore.
If you enjoy our content, hit the follow button and show us some love with a 5-star rating. Thanks for tuning in and exploring the universe from the heartlands.
Welcome, Prof. Fu, to the podcast.
Thanks a lot, Rishi. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Prof, maybe like we could start with just learning more about yourself. So as a child, did you always want to be a doctor?
So Rishi, this takes back quite a lot of years. I would have to say that it wasn't all that clear. I lived in a HDB flat and there was a really famous GP at the bottom of our block and my parents were in great adoration of him. Well, and every time that we went to see him for our family health and so on, there was always a comment that, wow, this guy is doing great work. So yeah, I guess it developed kind of from there. So I worked hard, studied hard and got into medical school.
Oh, okay. Wow. I mean, I guess we should thank that GP that played such an inspiring role. Can I check with you, like, if I'm right, you are a senior cardiologist consultant. So what made you choose this path?
So Rishi, that one's also not too difficult. When we were in med school, there were a few of us who are put together in something known as anatomy dissection table. This is the part where we do dissection over a human body. And the group of us were really fascinated with the heart. And we kind of drove each other into the craziness about hearts always. Then going further, when we started seeing patients using the stethoscope, that's also the thing that is most used by cardiologists, listening to heart sounds.
Right.
And then it came the interpretation of ECGs. So at every step of the way, there was always intrigue, at least for me in my mind, about cardiology and how the heart functions.
Okay.
So it was quite clear that I would take up that route of cardiology.
Oh, wow. I just want to go back to the part where you just casually mentioned dissection of the human body. So what was that like? Like, you know, the first time? Was it queasy?
Yeah, Rishi. Okay, so it really is interesting. The word is cadaver, right? So these are bodies that have been donated for the education and training of doctors. They got us into a room. At that time, this is how it happens. All 300, I think, of our students, first day at the dissection hall, we put our hands on each of our cadavers. 10 of us share one. And then we do a swearing. Today, we have a white coat ceremony for incoming medical students. In those days, the white coat was in this cadaver room.
Oh, wow.
And then the smell of formalin just hits you. Even today, if I were to smell it, it's something that you will never forget.
Oh, wow. It's like an initiation ceremony of sorts. We understand that you were a huge fan of Grey's Anatomy when you were growing up. And I think a lot of people listening to this were probably maybe a big fan of it as well. So was it anything like the TV show?
The ER or the A&E in the UK really was like that. On one of my first weeks being on call in King's College London, this is in the depths of South London, there were gunshot wounds that were coming in. There were broken legs. There were drunkards that were punching doctors. I got kicked and punched before.
Oh my God.
So it really is Grey's Anatomy. And also having to familiarize myself with all the slang terms for different types of drugs. Because here we only read it in textbooks and we don't get exposed to it.
Right.
And we don't even lesser knowledge know how to treat patients that come in with drug overdose.
Okay.
But there it's like bread and butter. And if you know London, South London in the days of the 1990s really was quite dark still. So it was quite an initiation. Yeah.
Wow, it sounds like chaos. That should have been you should have your own like Grey's Anatomy show. But you were saying that like it was really intense and you know, you had to deal with like gunshot wounds and all of that. So, I mean, this was really like in the early stages of your career, right? So how did you even, you know, get through the day without just being traumatized?
Oh, I was very traumatized. I mean, to be fair, a Singaporean, right? Chinese boy in a very comfortable, sheltered society of Singapore, being now exposed to all this kind of horror that I'm describing to you, which was very real. I have to say, remind you, it was really quite bad. I mean, on the weekends, like Saturdays and Friday evenings, ambulance will basically rove around that area to pick up drunkards from the street and bring them in.
Right.
And sometimes they are so over the hill that you don't even know what's the cause for their unconsciousness, etc. It can be really quite hairy and bad. I remember times when I would just run to the toilet and close the door. Oh my God, even bringing that up now. Just for a few minutes to chill myself in that room, in that small toilet, the toilet room. Yeah. But we go past it. It was interesting because I got to see another side of the world, I guess, or of life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also got to interact with all sorts of different people of different walks of life. Yeah.
Wow. I wasn't expecting like that level of intensity. Like this sounds like a lot worse than the TV show itself. But thank you so much, you know, for sharing that. And, you know, I think that's very exciting. I mean, from our point of view, but like you say, it was deeply traumatizing as well at that time. Moving on to a later stage in your career, you've also took part in many interesting projects. And one of it would be the Singapore Peranakan Genome Project. Could you tell us, you know, more about that and like what exactly is this project about?
Yeah, sure, Rishi. So that was the nice part about coming back to work in Singapore, because about the year 2012, 2013, when I came back, it really was boom time for genomics. And here in Singapore, there was so much resource that was being poured in. That was the key reason why I realized I cannot not come back to Singapore now. This is the huge opportunity. So the Peranakan project was conceived on the back of the Singapore Genome Project. So the government has put aside money. In fact, today is still doing it to sequence the population. So there are many people who maybe some of you listening have already been whole genome sequenced. In fact, I invite you to go for your whole genome sequence if you like. There is a population level sequencing project. And at that time, I mentioned to your colleague JC here that there was a scientist in our institute whose expertise is on this topic called genetic admixture. So he was very keen to study the genetics of each person and look for the mixture of ancestry. And he's from China and he's trained in the US. And he's at that time fairly unfamiliar with Singapore, but familiar enough to have tasted Peranakan food and realized there's this really interesting culture. So he reached out to me. I mean, we work in the same building, and asked if we would like to carry out Peranakan project on the back of the population sequencing project. Mm-hmm. So we managed to persuade the leaders of that population project to give us 1,000 allocation to sequence Peranakans. So we ended up sequencing 700 Peranakans and studying their genetic admixture.
Whoa, that is so cool. So maybe for like the lay people who don't really know so much about like DNA and sequencing, could you explain a bit about what exactly is admixture?
Okay, nice, JC. So the DNA is taken out of, well, in this case, we take it out of the blood. So we extract the blood from these volunteers, participants, subjects, and then we isolate and harvest the DNA out. And we actually, it's just biochemistry. It's put into a sequencing machine and the sequencing machine reads the genetic output, the genome of that individual.
So it's something like deciphering a recipe in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So in each one of us, we are made up of millions and gazillions of cells, and the cells each contain blueprint, which is our DNA.
How do you even like read these results? Is it like very technical, or like it just tells you like, okay, 20% Malay, 50% Chinese, or does the system like break it down in like such layman terms, or it's like very technical?
No, actually it's very simple. There are four bases that are called nucleic acids also in our DNA system. It's exactly the same DNA that all living things are made of. So like plants, insects, the whole world, right? Bacteria, every living thing has DNA. And the DNA made up of four bases or nucleic acids in different permutation and sequence, hence sequencing the term. Mm-hmm. And the way that it sequence comes out telling you which base is in which position. Right. And if you wanted to, it's possible to take that result and print it out into an encyclopedia of yourself.
Oh, wow.
So, for example, if you went to the Wellcome Trust Museum in London, there is in a cupboard the whole genome of a human being.
Whoa.
So that human being gave his blood and had himself sequenced, and now it's printed out into something like 50 volumes of his genome.
Oh.
So if you open each book, 50 volumes of them, right, you will see the letters A, C, G, T representing the four bases.
Okay.
And of course, it's like hieroglyphics, right? You are reading A, C, G, T, G, G, T, T, E, G, A, C. So it's basically a long string of letters. I am told that statistically, if you stretch out the letters, it will run for 9,000 kilometers. And if we think that there are 3 billion bases per genome, then that's several thousand Bibles. So that's your 5th volumes.
And that's just one person.
One person's genome.
That is a lot of information.
Could fill up a library.
Yes. So I assume that in this project, you took all this information from different people and then you compared them and then you found like more about their heritage and their ancestry. So going back to the Peranakan Genome Project, like how did you manage to convince the Peranakans to participate? Like what made them want to donate their blood and DNA for this?
Oh yeah, JC, that part was really fun. So the Peranakan people in Singapore are a very tight-knit community. And somehow or other, we know of a few Peranakan friends who are quite prominent in that community. I suppose I can mention his name. One of them is Peter Lee, who is very prominent in even hosting some TV shows around histories around this area, right? Southeast Asian history. So it wasn't hard before someone like Peter Lee and a few of the others floated this project up to the community and they gathered around it with great force, all wanting to participate and contribute their DNA.
Wow, that's nice. They must be very proud of their heritage.
Yeah, you're right. They are. I mean, they're also very keen to find out about this kind of ancestry questions.
So tapping on that, how did they respond to the results of the research?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I better be careful what I say. A lot of them were interested to know whether there really is so-called Malay ancestry in their genetics. There's always this, they are much better at telling this story themselves. I mean, I'm not Peranakan myself. There's always this legend that there was a Chinese princess that came from China. Mm-hmm. And from her, with the local Malay leaders, gave rise to the Peranakans that we have now today. There's also another legend that a lot of the Chinese merchants that came from China hooked up with local indigenous ladies and then had the Peranakan culture and so on. So I think in a way, the genetic experiment or project, I guess, revealed some of these, if you believe the science that came out of it, which we do, of course, then it's saying that there really is Malay ancestry in Peranakans quite clearly, quite distinctly.
So based on your study, which legend do you think corresponds to your results the most?
The one that involves a female Malay ancestor.
Right.
So the research reveals, and it's published and peer-reviewed, etc., reveals that about 6 to 9 generations ago, a Malay female ancestor exists in this Peranakan people. But don't forget that this was taking the blood of individuals that are self-declaring as Peranakans.
Right.
So it's really more, at the end of the day, a lot of this is an agreement that this is more cultural than, you know, a hard and fast rule. Mm-hmm. You can't say you are not Peranakan because you don't have this.
Right.
Because a lot of them are practicing Peranakans today culturally. But in a general analysis of the entire 700 people, most of them have 5% amount of Malay ancestry in genetics in their genome.
Wow.
Which is more than you would find in a person who is self-declared as a Chinese, like myself, for example.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
So for myself, which is, I would say I'm fully Chinese because I don't practice Peranakan culture, etc. My genetics does not show any Malay ancestry.
I used to have a dream where if I could trace back my ancestry, I was hoping to be related to some like South Indian king or like some royalty. Yeah. Would you be able to actually trace it back to a single person?
Well, so Rishi, you probably are a descendant of Kublai Khan and Genghis Khan.
Whoa.
So there are people who, yeah, I think all of us are.
Oh,
so that's the sad thing too. So there is a line of research that is looking exactly as at evolution and evolutionary genetics.
Okay, okay.
So start from this point. Each one of us have two parents, right? And the two parents have two parents and so on. So two to the power of N.
Yeah.
And if you build up the pedigree going backwards, you end up with millions of people as being your ancestors to which you are descendant. But the reality is that it wasn't so many people that lived during that time. There is a lot of people that occupy more than one position in that tree.
Yeah.
Right? So it's more a web than a tree.
Okay. Actually, that's an interesting way to put it, like a web. Yeah.
So in this web, if you go back enough times, there's such a thing known as a genetic isopoint, where everybody that lived in that year, if they have descendants living today, they would be the ancestor of everybody today.
Whoa.
That is mind-blowing.
Yeah, this. So you're saying that everyone, okay, not everyone, but a lot of the people who are listening to this podcast are probably related to Genghis Khan.
Yeah, it's true. Yes, because if you can say that Genghis Khan has a descendant today, then he must be an ancestor to everybody today if he has passed the isogenetic point.
Whoa. Okay. That's a fact that I'm going to use any icebreaker now that I'm a descendant of Genghis Khan. But that's so interesting, right? Like, I mean, I don't think we've looked at ancestry that way, at least for a layman like me. Like, we always thought like everyone's different roots and different people. But, you know, if we go down the route, like it's a web and it's all just linked to a few people.
Yeah. It means all of us are actually related and connected to one another.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, no.
That is exactly the point, that there is sufficient inbreeding if you look at it at a very high level.
Wow. Mm. Okay. Maybe we'll not like dwell too much into that. I do not want to ruin any relationships.
But also the point that there are many of us who share ancestors that we are not even aware of. I think that's the most important thing that comes out of this.
So if you really put in effort to do like the research and the samples, you can actually find a lot of like similarities.
Yeah. I mean, a really good one is in the UK, because in the UK, you know, the royal family line, they really know who each king and queen descended from.
Mm.
And they can trace their ancestry, I mean, at least in the royal line, all the way up to, let's say, Edward the First and so on.
Right.
So if Edward the First, and he does have ancestors in the royal family today, right? Mm-hmm. Or descendants in the royal family today. He's actually the ancestor of everybody living in England today.
Whoa. That's insane. that's pretty insane. Okay. That seems similar to what you referenced a Richard Dawkins quote on another podcast, Third Spacing, about how our 185th million grandfather was a fish. So the fish in the market, my cousin's bro.
It's a very different looking fish. Okay, please do look up Richard Dawkins' book. I mean, it's fascinating. I think it really helps you to rethink life altogether. And it's true, if you think that, okay, so the analogy he uses, and here I'm just reconfiguring what he actually says.
Okay.
So it's not my own thinking. If you put the photograph of your father and then your father's father and your father's his father and his father and line it all the way back, and if you go back to that generation I described to you, is actually the picture of a fish. And then if you go back even further, I mean, depends on how far you want to go, then it's a single cell, for example, you know, the beginning of life.
Right.
Mm.
So in a sense, like, just like a fish when like humans were not around.
Mm, yeah, exactly. So the idea is that it's very hard to say when species started, because the transition is, it's so hard to think of this in the evolutionary time frame.
Okay.
And that's where our human brain maybe cannot even think of it.
Right.
I mean, even in our human life, I mean, when did you stop being a teenager and becoming an adult? It's a gradual process happens, right? And that's the same when did Homo sapiens became Homo sapiens and before it was the species before that. And the thing that I find it hard to square up even is that species can only breed to give its own species, right?
But yeah.
So how does a new species come out of that?
Oh.
So these are really tough questions to get over in the mind, but it's just explained by this very gradual process over evolutionary time.
I mean, I guess that's the mysteries of the world, right? Like, we'll never figure out, like, just when we think we have all the answers, the questions change, you know?
Yeah, that is the beauty of science.
Yes. Hello there, it's time for the Mid-Roll app. You're probably listening to this on the MRT with headphones or maybe out loud. Have you ever thought about the DNA that encodes the shape of your ears? Did you know that the University of Pittsburgh scientists found out that 49 genes contribute to earlobe attachment? Head down to the Science Centre Singapore to learn more weird facts about DNA and the human body. I am here to ask like all the paisei questions, as I promised in the start of this show. So what exactly is DNA for those, you know, who have been listening to this podcast up till this moment and they're like, why is this guy talking about DNA? What exactly is DNA?
What do you think, JC? What should we say?
Help me out here.
It's the thing that I mentioned about the four bases or the four nucleic acids, A, C, G, and T. These are the four letters of life. And okay. If you take out the DNA and sequence it, it literally is the four letters in the different sequence. And every cell in our body has that blueprint of those letters. So every cell has the same sequence.
So essentially, it is what makes us, us, in the most abstract way possible that I can put it.
So it's like a code in a sense where we have all these four letters and they are arranged in different orders. And then different orders of the letters will give us a different code. And then the code will determine different characteristics that we have or different features. For example, like the proteins in our body, the color of our eyes, the color of our hair, something like that.
We mentioned that every cell has the same DNA code. So that's like the blueprint.
Right.
And the blueprint, as what JC says, gives rise to all the ways in which the cells function.
Right.
And actually, if you want to take one more step further, the interesting thing in recent years is the discovery that different cells function differently, even though they have the same blueprint.
Oh, okay.
Right. So a brain cell in the same person, a brain cell and his lung cell and his heart cell and liver cell all have the same blueprint,
okay,
the same DNA code,
mm-hmm,
but they do different things and they function differently. The brain cell functions differently from the liver cell.
Is that because they're different parts of the body?
No. Like, so it really, at the end of the day, it turns out that the code is just the blueprint and different part of the code is being used in different cells.
Wow. Okay.
So it's like, and the analogy I've used is like songbook. Mm-hmm. Every cell has exactly the same songbook. That's their blueprint. But different songs are being sung from that songbook.
Right, right. So like they're just using the notes differently in a sense.
Exactly.
Okay. I think that's a nice way to put it.
So because the different notes are being used, then they are carrying out the function so differently. And when we move into disease from health, then some of these songs become out of tune.
Oh, okay.
Mm. Oh, so I think what you're referring to is your research on epigenetics, if I'm not wrong. So Prof nice just gave us a very good analogy about what epigenetics is. Mm. And I believe he's referring to his research on how the epigenetics affects like heart health and also heart disease.
Mm. Yeah.
So maybe you could tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, JC, thanks. So it's also around Nobel Prize winning stuff that came out 20 years ago when they discovered that the way that different parts of the genome is being used is based on certain modification and features that drive how the genome is used in each cell type. And so much to a point where if you can rewire some of these modifications, you can actually make the cell change and behave differently. So to give a more concrete analogy, if you take liver cell and you grow it on a plate and allow it to divide, it will always divide into more liver cells.
Okay.
Because the code is hardwired there. So only the songs of a liver cell will sing. But if you find a way to rewire it, the genome, and make it sing different songs, you can actually turn the liver cell into a heart cell.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And that was the groundbreaking Nobel Prize 20 years ago. So with that knowledge, everyone has gone hunting for the rewiring processes. And the thinking is that in our context of the heart, if the songs are going out of tune, can we find specific ways to retune it so that the wires are back into health?
Okay.
And that's the epigenetic research that we're working on.
Whoa. So if you compare, maybe go back to the analogy of a songbook, they are sort of like little markers to tell the sort of cell which pages to read from.
Mm.
So if we were to find out which markers are marking the pages and then maybe you can sort of tweak them a bit, then maybe we have the possibility of helping to reduce the risk of certain diseases like heart disease.
Mm, exactly. Yeah, very nicely put too, JC. So for example, in the heart, in the case of the heart, when we have a heart attack, the heart muscle dies, right?
Mm.
The cells die. And it gets replaced by these things called fibroblasts. They're all scarring cells, scar cells. So these guys came up, not my lab, but some other lab, showed that you can actually put in these rewiring factors and rewire so that the scar cells turn into heart cells.
Whoa.
So completely changing them.
And making them behave differently altogether. So if you think that scar cells, you don't want them, you should get them back to heart cells, you can actually change the cause of heart failure completely. So this has worked seemingly in mouse. We also see it in our own hands using those rewiring factors. And I think there are people in the world who are trying to ultimately bring it to clinic one day.
So you're kind of reversing like damages to the heart that was previously thought, okay, this is a permanent damage. Your heart will, you know, after a few heart attacks, your heart is pretty weak and there's nothing that we can do except like, you know, just take good care of it. But now you can actually rewire it to be back to how it was.
Yeah, so good that you are saying it like that, Rishi. Definitely spot on.
Oh, okay, yes. Great. I learned something today.
Yes. Because I think usually, if I understand correctly, after a heart attack, there will be like scar tissue on the wall of the heart. Then that interferes somewhat with the pumping of the heart. And then that will sort of contribute or lead to heart failure, which for now, I think can only be managed by like good lifestyle control medications.
Right.
So this is really some groundbreaking research. If we really can reverse these changes,
I
think can provide people a new lease of life.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely, Jesse. I mean, that's the whole space of regenerative medicine as well. To get organs to repair themselves, especially organs like the heart that are not reparative.
We would now like to play some games with you. Word association game. So basically, we will be asking you words, like certain words in like quick fire. And, you know, we just want to see like what comes to your mind first. First word is health.
Disease.
Why is that the first thing that comes to your mind?
Well, that's the opposite, right? So people are healthy, but they become diseased. We want to convert them back to health. I mean, at the moment in my head, these are the juxtaposition. This is the juxtaposition I keep thinking about.
Right. Okay. Apple.
Orange.
So we're just going with like opposite fruits now. Okay.
It's better than saying doctor, right? Apple, they keep the doctor away.
Cliche, I see. Heart.
Lung.
Oh. Why would that come up?
So in our research space, very often heart research institutes are set together with heart and lung institutes.
Right. Is there like some correlation?
Maybe it's just organs in the chest.
Right. They're like cousins. Okay. Bloodline.
Oh, Vikings. How come I'm thinking of the word Vikings?
Was it a show?
Could well be. So the way that blood is so gory and the Vikings are fighting people. And then there's always this talk about ancestry. My knowledge about ancestry is very British and European based.
Right.
And it always dates to the Vikings.
Oh.
For me, Bloodline would have been like Game of Thrones because they're always talking about ancestry and who has the right to sit on the throne.
Yes, it's always sort of associated with like royalty in like pop culture for some reason. Yeah.
And like pure blood and like... Okay, but good to know. What shows you like, Prof. Peranakan.
What's that? What? Buah kula?
Oh, that's the...
The dish.
Yeah, it uses...
A nut.
Yes, and actually the nut is like a bit toxic or something, right?
It's true, and they need to soak it for the longest of time to then actually cook it.
Right, right.
You know, there's some really special technique that goes into cooking that dish.
Did you have a lot of it during the research phase?
Yeah, probably too much.
Gattaca? Is it Gattaca?
Oh yeah, that's the amazing sci-fi show that actually quite a number of us talk about from time to time.
Oh.
There was a moment in time when we were crafting the first heart disease project, and a lot of the projects in our clinical space always come with abbreviations.
Okay.
Like the one that I'm now running together with team is called Project Reset.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always a name to it, right? So they wanted to use Gattaca as the name because it was very DNA-based. I've not actually watched the movie myself, but it sounds really interesting.
So it's a movie, like an old movie? Or
science fiction movie where people came in and they could buy their DNA. They can exchange their DNA from a window like in the bank teller.
Wow. Okay, I need to check this out. So thank you so much, Prof, for joining us today. You know, like I think we had a lot of fun learning about our ancestry, your Peranakan Genome Project. I think my biggest takeaway was that I'm either linked to a fish or to Genghis Khan. What about you, JC?
Well, it was absolutely mind-blowing to hear that. But it was also super fascinating to hear about all your research on like heart health and like about the prospect of like regenerative medicine and how like the different markers can sort of help different cells to sort of perform different roles. It's really exciting research.
Very nice, JC. Very nice, Rishi. Thanks for giving the chance at this.
Thank you, Prof. And thanks everyone for listening. So subscribe to Void Deck to be the first to know when new geeky episodes about science in Singapore are released. You can stay updated with Prof. Roger Fu's work by following fu-lab.sg.
Are you above 40 years old? Consider joining Project Reset, a nationwide heart health study. Gain insights into your metabolism, heart and liver health, and find out how you can lower your risk of cardiovascular diseases like heart attack and stroke. If you're under 40, encourage your parents to sign up. It's a chance for them to advance medical science while learning more about their own health.
Can't wait for the next episode or curious to learn more about DNA and the human body? Come down to Science Centre Singapore, visit our revamped exhibit on bioethics and learn more about the science of aging at Dialogue with Time with your parents and grandparents. See you in the next episode.
Thank you.